Church, if you have your Bibles with you this morning, we're going to be in a variety of passages, but I'd ask you to open to the book of John. That's where we're going to be to begin with. We are in a brand new sermon series. It's going to be for this entire month, so 4 Sundays in a row. And our topic is going to be a very interesting one because we're going to be speaking or listening and learning about heaven. I want to start off with a quote this morning, and this is the quote from Charles Kettering. He is a guy that was an inventor, an American businessman. He said, "We should all be concerned about the future because we will have to spend the rest of our lives there. It seems rather important that we would think about a place where we're going to spend eternity." I like to travel. Anybody like to travel out there? Raise your hand if you like to travel. I suspect that it's almost 100% of us that like travel. There might be a few homebodies, but traveling is a good thing. And one of my favorite parts of travel is preparing. I know that sounds a little strange, but I get very excited about a place where I'm going to go. Denise and I have the privilege this summer of leading 21 students and some parents to Turkey this summer. We're going to be going and seeing some of our ministry partners, learning about Turkey. And one of my favorite parts of preparing for that is like, okay, like what are we going to go see? We have this many days in Istanbul, too many things to see, so what's the choices? And where are we going to go? How are we going to get around? You know, how are we going to learn some phrases? Denise and I are in the process right now of trying to learn some Turkish phrases. And we're struggling a little bit with it, but we're trying to help each other out with that. And so one of the things that we're doing is trying to get ready for that moment. And that's one of my favorite parts of travel. Here's my question for you today. If I am that excited about 10 days in Turkey, how much more excited should I be about a place I'm going to go for eternity? I'm just dropping that out there with you today to say that seems like we would take a great interest in what heaven might be like because we have a long time there. And so we would be motivated to learn about that. Over the next 4 weeks, we're going to be talking about heaven. And my hunch is that you have not done much serious thinking or perhaps reading about that. And furthermore, I'm a little bit embarrassed to tell you this, but in my 35 years of pastoral ministry, there has not been one series that I've ever done on heaven. I mean, I say that a little shamefully. I mean, there's been tangentially times where we've talked about heaven. Sure, that's come up, no problem. But for the first time, I'm saying, hey, for a prolonged period of time, let's talk about heaven, and let's talk about the theology of heaven, what God says about heaven, and let's get a little bit excited about that. Now, why do you think it is that we talk so little about heaven? Well, I don't know. It just seems to be a topic that doesn't come up very much today in our society, in our conversations. I think in yesteryear, it used to come up more than it does today. And maybe I could conjecture some reasons about that, but I want to remedy that. I want it to be something that we talk openly about. Now, in order to get ready for this series, I have had a little informal poll that's been going on with some friends. And so I get together with some friends, maybe we're in the car for a long drive, and I say, hey, I'm going to be speaking about heaven in a couple of months. Would you help me? I have a little informal quiz for you or a poll for you, 4 questions. And they always say, sure, let's go over that. And so these are the 4 questions that I have been asking my friends. And I've been doing this with both friends who follow Christ and those who don't yet follow Christ. And I've been asking them these 4 questions. Do you believe in heaven? Do you believe in hell? What is heaven like? And who is in heaven? And this been engaging conversations. Can I encourage you over this month when we're talking more about heaven, ask those 4 questions to friends that you know. I guarantee you it will start lots of good conversation. By the way, can I also just tell you, you do not need to be highly rebuttal. Ask good questions. Listen long. There was a time in the car where I was with a friend a month ago or so, asked those 4 questions. He spoke for 35 minutes straight, and all I did was ask more questions, and he just kept on going. So this is a good opportunity for you to engage some friends about this topic again of heaven and the overall theology around this. I will tell you this, nearly everybody believes in heaven. Now, I had a few non-Christian friends that said, I'm not sure, But the more that we went into the other questions, the more it was evident that it's like, well, you have an answer to, you know, what heaven's like and who's going to be there. So I'm assuming that you probably do. But here's a surprise. 100% of my non-Christian friends said this. No hell. No, I do not believe in hell. And that was just like immediate. It was like visceral. It was emphatic. And more on that in a moment of what I make of that. But that was one of the things that followed from my little survey or my little questionnaire, is that most, again, that are not Christians do not believe that there is a hell. In the coming weeks, we're going to be talking in depth about heaven. We're going to be talking about things like what we do in heaven, who will be in heaven, what our bodies will be like in heaven, what is heaven like? I mean, what does it feel like to be there? That's going to be some of the questions that we're going to be going through. And I will just tell you, there's one resource. I've had several resources, but there's one resource that has meant especially a lot to me. It has helped me a lot. And it's Randy Alcorn's book, Heaven. I have it here on the screen for you. It's a pretty big book, so a little daunting. It's 500 pages long. Randy Alcorn answers every question you could really ever think about related to heaven. We're going to use some of the stuff that's in his book over the next 4 weeks together. And of course, I only get 30 minutes at a crack. He gets a lot longer with the book. And so I'm hoping for some of you, if you're really saying, hey, I really want to dig in and understand this better, that that might be a book that you would pick up. I know that you won't regret that. It's one I've had on my shelf for a number of years, sold over 1 million copies, by the way. So, you know, hey, this is really something that a lot of Christians have found very helpful in their journey of understanding heaven. Today, I have one simple goal. So this is what I want you to hear and act upon today. One simple goal. I want you to come leave this place today saying heaven and hell are real. Heaven and hell are real. That's what I want you to leave today with. This is not some imaginary idea. Heaven and hell are real. And, you know, some of you are saying, Pastor, I'm already there. Well, you know, good for you. All right. I like that. But we want that to be fortified. We want that to be believed at an even deeper level, and we want to live in light of that. And so that's my goal for us today. An overwhelming majority of Americans believe that there is life after death. In fact, studies say in America today, 73% of Americans would say there is a heaven. And so again, the majority of people are saying that heaven, and as a matter of fact, hell exists. A researcher involved in this study said this. He said, most people are cutting and pasting religious views from a variety of different sources. And therefore, what they view about, they may believe that heaven and hell exist, but their view of heaven and hell varies widely. He says, most of them are collecting different sources like television, movies, YouTube, conversations with their friends. The result is a highly subjective theology of the afterlife that's disconnected, for the most part, from a biblical reality or a biblical doctrine of what heaven is like. So maybe the next step for us today, if you're already in the spot of saying, I believe there's a heaven and a hell, then maybe the next spot is to actually believe rightly about that, to believe something that actually the Bible is teaching about that, rather than this collection of odd views. There seems to be the thought today that heaven may be more of a state of mind, and that hell is more like a country club, and that it's more desirable in many ways than hell is. Hell is more desirable than heaven is. I mean, so that needs to be, or is one way that people are kind of thinking about the two of those today. Let me give you an example. I really like the writing of Mark Twain. I think that Tom Sawyer is one of those books that's just an ancient classic, and I just love reading it. I get tickled every time I read it. But I don't tend to agree with Mark Twain when he talks about hell. And in fact, he talks about hell quite a lot. I could give you a number of quotes of his about hell, but here's one of them, and it's one where I probably disagree with Mark Twain. He says, go to heaven for the climate, hell for the company. And what he's saying here is, you know, hey, hell's got all kinds of interesting people, and that's, you know, what I would really like about hell is that I would be with a lot of people that maybe didn't make their way to heaven, but it would be wonderful, it would be great. And Mark Twain is, you know, revealing something to us. He's saying, you know, this idea of hell is really kind of more like a joke. And, you know, the popular thought today is that hell is really, it's just the prison I put myself in. You know, that's the idea of what is around hell. Today, I want to talk biblically. I want to talk clearly about both heaven and hell. And again, my goal today is for you to leave this place saying, I believe there's a heaven and I believe there is a hell, and that those are real places. All right, first, and I have four ways I want to help you understand why heaven and hell, how heaven and hell are real. The first one is heaven and hell are real because they are physical places. One of the most important verses about heaven, and one that we're going to refer to very repeatedly. As a matter of fact, that's why I had you turn to the book of John. We're in John chapter 14, starting in verse 2. And these are words of Jesus. He says, in my Father's house, there are many rooms. If we're not so, would I have not told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again, and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. Isn't it interesting that Jesus chooses to use some very common terms, house, rooms, place, to describe where he is going and where he is inviting you to follow him? He's saying, I'm going to take you home. He speaks of a room that's specifically prepared for you. He speaks of coming to take you to that very special room, very personal. And, you know, that sounds quite real to me. Jesus has gone out of his way to paint the picture of this dwelling place that is seemingly a very real place. I would imagine that what he's talking about here is somewhere where it's warm, where we would feel loved, we would feel wanted, we would feel a sense of belonging. And all of that has a physical nature to it, a physical location to it. Heaven is a real place that Jesus is creating for us. And it's meant to be an eternal dwelling. He also calls it a place of our great rest. If we're working hard and we're in much travail in this life, he's saying the next one is a place where we would feel a level of rest, a level of comfort. Now, this might be a surprise to you, but Jesus speaks also of the physical and permanent spot called hell. And Jesus talks about hell in very physical ways. He's the one in the Bible, this is maybe a surprise to you, but Jesus talks more about hell than any other writer in the Bible. And this is something that he speaks very forthrightly on. He talks about a physical location in very graphic terms, a spot where there's raging fire, where there's a worm that doesn't die, the idea of a worm that's eating. He talks about it as a place of darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. I challenge you to go home today and put into Google these three words, Jesus, Bible, hell, and see what comes up. You will be surprised. There are so many passages where Jesus talks about hell. In fact, little alert here, Jesus talks more about hell than he does heaven. So this is, wow, something that Jesus is like really on point about. And Jesus talks all the time about this as being a place. Can I give you one example? I could choose many, but I'm in Matthew chapter 13, and this is a story that Jesus tells. It's a parable. He says, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind. When it was full, men drew it ashore and sat down and sorted the good into containers, but threw away the bad. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them, meaning the evil ones, into the fiery furnace. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Let me explain to you what's going on here. Jesus is comparing our lives to fish. And he's saying fishermen go out and they do their fishing for the day. They would always come back onto the shore and they would take all the fish they caught that day and they would separate them out. They would separate the fish that are edible and good to sell at the market from those that are not edible or trashy fish. And, you know, the ones that have no market. And they would separate those two out. And so he's using that metaphor in the ancient world to say, that's what the end of the world is going to be like. There's going to be angels that are going to come and they're going to separate the righteous from the wicked. And the wicked are going to go towards an eternal destruction. Jesus says, this is no illusion. It's no joke. It's a real place. Heaven is a real place. Hell is a real place. And Jesus speaks about both of them in those ways. There's another way heaven and hell are real, and it's because our bodies and our spirits are real. You and I were designed to be a unity of soul and body. We all have both a soul and a body, and those operate in a union together. And so Jesus says that we are individuals who will always need another body. We're going to lose this body here on this earth, but we're going to be combined with another body. And spoiler alert, we're going to talk about bodies in heaven in weeks to come. But spoiler alert, you're going to get a new body. And the new body is one that never undergoes decay. It's not given over to the sin nature, so it's pure, it's right, it's good. And he's saying here, I'm always going to be uniting you back into a body because that's where you're meant to dwell. I love fishing. Many of you know that. I love fly fishing especially. And I always love to watch a trout in the water that just glides so smoothly and then comes up and just takes either my fly or, again, a fly of some kind off the surface of the water. And they just do it so delicately. And just boom, and they just sip it. I just love to watch that. It's like poetry to me. A fish is in water and doesn't even know it. I mean, that's where he lives. It's what's natural. You take a fish out of water, and that's when there's problems because he can't breathe anymore. His gills don't work in the air, and so he's going to die rather quickly. You, like the fish, are meant to be in a body. And a body needs a place for it to exist, a space for it to exist. I am not saying that heaven is going to be exactly like earth, but I think there's going to be some striking similarities, and your body is needing a place of physical nature to rest in or be in, and that's another reason why, again, heaven and hell are going to be real. A third way heaven and hell are real is that heaven is pure and perfect. When we talk about heaven, what do we really mean by that word? I've got a quote from one of my favorite theologians, Wayne Grudem. He says, heaven is the place where God most fully makes known his presence to bless. And so God has the capability of being everywhere, but in heaven, he is this unique location, this spot where you're there, you understand his role as his holiness, and he has this unique presence at that moment to bless those that are around him. And that's what's going on when, again, people are in heaven surrounded around God, is that they're feeling the blessing, the joy of worship, the joy of being with him. And heaven is a space where there is perfect purity and there is perfection, and therefore it's a place where there is no sin. Sin is eradicated in heaven. And so, who is in heaven? That's a good question. Hold on to that thought for just a moment. I told you that in my informal survey, I had friends, and one friend that was not a follower of Jesus said there was no hell, and I asked her, I said, you know, that was rather quick. I mean, you really decisively said there's absolutely no hell. I said, explain that to me. What do you mean by that? And she said, well, isn't hell just a marketing ploy for people to, you know, respond and do what the church wants them to do? And I'm like, wow, okay, where do I even begin here? I mean, like, what do we do with this? Most people today, nearly everybody today, believes again that there is a heaven. And many today would believe that everybody goes to heaven. That thought is called universalism. That's the title, the theological title given to that. And if you really press people on that, they're like, well, maybe not Hitler, and, you know, maybe not the serial murderer, and maybe not a few others, you know. So there's, if you press them on really, like, really everybody, you find out there's some holes in the argument pretty quickly. But here's my question for you. What is it that Jesus says? What does Jesus say about heaven and hell? And what does Jesus say about who's there and who gets there and why they get there? Well, here's Jesus, Matthew chapter 7, and he says, enter by the narrow gate. He's talking about himself, by the way, as being that gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. And so Jesus is saying here, there is a path, there is a way, there is a gate, and it's a narrow gate. And he's saying, I am calling you to travel through the narrow gate, because wide is the gate, or wide is the pathway that leads to destruction, and most people are on that path. Because we, again, are sinful, we are individuals that are inherently doing things in rebellion against God, and sometimes we know that, and we say, God, I know what you do. I'm going to do I know what you want me to do. I'm not going to do it. Or sometimes we're just even saying, you know, I just don't even feel like engaging at all. And so we are individuals who, again, have made our own path. We've become our own kings, and that's in rebellion against God. As a result of that, relationship with God is broken. And as a result of that, again, sin is separating us from him. And he's saying, in your current state, I can't have you here in heaven with me. And so we can't enter heaven as we are. So here's the thing I want you to hear right now, is that heaven is not your default position. Heaven is not the place you automatically are scheduled to go to. Because of your sin and rebellion against God, hell is actually the default position. That's where you're destined to go without some kind of intervention, because your flesh is taking you there. And by the way, I say that, and I realize right now how non-PC I am. I mean, this is just like, what? I'm trying today to tell you, not Pastor Brian's opinion. I probably would have written a very, very different story. But I'm trying to tell you what God is revealing to us in the scriptures. And he's saying, your default position is not heaven, but hell. Let me try to help us with that a little bit. There's a pastor that I read this week, and he asked the question. He said, how much sin do you think God would be wise to let into heaven? Could he let 5% of sin into heaven? How about 0.5%? Would that be okay? He goes on and says, you know, when we have Olympic athletes, they are tested for performance-enhancing drugs. They get done with a match, and their blood is tested, and, you know, they go through a rigorous process in order to make sure that somebody hasn't cheated by taking some of those drugs. And, you know, how much is the measure of that? You know, can you have a little bit and that's okay? No, the test is really that it's got to be 100% that you did not use any performance-enhancing drugs. Let's say people had traces of that. They say, well, you know, I only used a little bit of that. Well, I'm sorry, but that's not the test. The test is no performance-enhancing drugs. That's what it takes to do the Olympics clean. Here's another one. You go to the blood bank, and you say to the blood bank, here's my blood, and they're going to test it now. They're going to say, hey, is there anything we should be looking for here? Is everything okay with the blood? Oh, yeah, everything's fine. Well, we tested the blood, and we're testing it usually for, like, HIV. We're testing it for malaria. And you say, well, you know, I was in a spot where there was malaria, and, if I got it, I only got a little bit of it. It's like, sorry, no. We need blood that's, like, perfect, because we want to make sure and give that to somebody, and they're not going to get infected with what, you know, you had. And so, again, the standard for blood is that it's totally usable, not infected. The same is true for our relationship with God. The standard for heaven is sinless perfection. Just as when Adam and Eve were brought into the world and they had not fallen yet into sin, their lives were perfect. That's what God is looking for. Comparatively good person is not enough. If God is putting his eternal dwelling together, it's a dimension in which the spiritual makeup of everybody is perfect, and we're no longer polluting heaven. In fact, if we let sin into heaven, then we would be back to the same spot where we are now, where there's just successive sin after sin that continues to pollute the whole environment. And so God is saying, I have a plan and a solution for this whole thing, and hell is my solution because I put infection and I put infected people there. And that's the way that I make sure that heaven is going to be the spot where it's going to be eternal and right and pure. Now, when I was growing up, I have to announce this to you, I was not a follower of Jesus. And I listened to a lot of rock music. There was one band I listened to called AC/DC. Many of you know where I'm going to go right now. I'm on a highway to hell. Bam, bam, bam. And you know, I sang that song. And it wasn't until years later that I really thought about that. I was like, I'm singing that I'm on a highway to hell like I want to be. I mean, again, it just was a kind of wake-up call. It's like, no, that's not something to joke about. That's not something that's good. That's not something that I want for me or for anybody else. It's not something to celebrate. Here's what I want you to hear today. It's far too easy to go to hell. It requires no change of course, no navigational adjustments. We were born to be on autopilot to head to hell. And that's nothing to take lightly. In fact, I would hope that most of us would talk about hell with a tear in the eye. Heaven is a place where God dwells. It requires purity. It requires perfection. And by the way, that's not you, and that is not me. Let's turn the corner and see if we can find out some good news here. Maybe a little bit more bad news before we get good news, but here we go. Fourth, heaven and hell are real, and they follow a very real and great judgment. The Bible claims that Jesus ascended to heaven after he rose from the grave. We celebrated that last Sunday. And Jesus is going to return. And when he returns, he says that he collects everybody, the dead as well as the living. He collects them all, and there is going to be a great judgment. Revelation chapter 20. Here's the passage. It's a little bit of a longer one, but here we go. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. The earth and the heavens fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. Next one. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. Anybody whose name was not found written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. That's the way it's recorded in the book of Revelation. Everybody who's done anything is recorded in these books. You can imagine what they're going to be like. Huge tomes, maybe entire like cabinets, you know, that are going to roll out with all the things that we've said or done, our motivations of the heart. And these are going to be brought against us in judgment. All of us have done wrong. We've all rebelled against God. We've all broken the law. And so everybody is going to be found guilty and wanting. And so the question is, well, how could anybody's name be written in the Lamb's Book of Life? That seems like an impossibility because nobody can get to that spot. Friends, I don't typically do this, but I want you right now to open your Bibles to the book of Revelation, and I want you to open to Revelation chapter 5. If you've got a phone with a Bible app on it, do that. Maybe you've got a friend, you can look over their shoulder. I don't mind that. But Revelation chapter 5, and this is the way that God records the answer to that question. How can your name be written in the Lamb's Book of Life? It's a little bit of a longer passage, but it's worth reading. Here it is. Revelation chapter 5, starting in verse 6. Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne, and when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of God's people, and they sang a new song. Now pay attention to the song. Here it is. You're worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on earth. Then I looked and heard one voice of many angels numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000s upon 10,000s. They circled the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and in a loud voice they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." And then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea, and all of them were saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and glory and honor and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. You see what's happening there? The Lamb, who looked as if it had been slain, it looked like his throat got slit, was there. And he's the one that goes up and is able to take these scrolls and open this book of life and is able to usher people into life, into forgiveness. And it's not because they were such good people. It's not because they led good lives. It's not because they did more good than bad. It was because they were covered in his blood, his forgiveness. He was the one who was able to forgive and place names into the Lamb's book of life. I'm hoping that's what you want today. I'm hoping that's something of value to you today. Because as we close here today, I want you to know that there's two eternal destinations, two real places. And it is a real choice to choose the right path. Jesus is saying, nobody comes to the Father except through me. And so he's saying, I'm this path that leads to the Father. The stakes are high around heaven and hell. And I'm hoping that as we talk more about heaven especially, that it will whet your appetite for that. You'll want that even more. And that talking about hell today, in addition to that, is going to help you come to the space of saying, man, it makes me ever more grateful for God, because it's not something I've done. It's not something I've earned. It's not that I'm a great person. It's that God has shown mercy to me, and he's given me the blood of Jesus. I want to close today with a story, true story, that happened right here in Seattle. And there was a gal, her name is Ruthanna Metzger. She's a professional singer. And years ago, she was invited to go and attend a wedding and sing at a reception that was downtown in Seattle's Columbia Tower. She said that they arrived there at Columbia Tower, and she said it was gorgeous. They had drinks and stuff on the ground floor as everybody walked in. And they announced that the dinner was going to be up a stairwell. And she said the stairwell was this beautiful glass and brass staircase that led up several floors to the spot where the bride and the groom had already headed, and everybody else was ushered in and invited to go. So they made their way up the stairwell. And at the top of the stairs, the maitre d' found a book that was a book on the table. And he had it open. And he says, may I have your name, please? She says, I'm Ruthanna Metzger, and this is my husband, Roy. And he searched through the M's, and he said, I'm not finding it. Would you spell that again for me? Ruthanna spelled her name very slowly. And after looking through the book, the maitre d' looked and said, I'm so sorry, but your name is not here. She said, there must be some kind of mistake. I'm the singer. I just sang at the wedding. And he said, I'm sorry, but your name is not in the book. And he called over one of the waiters and he said, would you escort these people to the service elevator? And she said, I left towards the service elevator, slowly walking as I went, noticing the beautifully decorated tables, the shrimp, the whole smoked salmon, the magnificent carved ice sculptures. And adjacent to the banquet area, there was an orchestra that was preparing to perform, the musicians all dressed in dazzling white tuxes. The waiter led Ruthanna and Roy to the service elevator. He ushered them in and he pressed G for parking garage. And the elevator went down. After driving just a few minutes, Ruthanna's husband reached over and put his hand on her leg and said, sweetheart, what just happened? She said, well, when the invitation arrived, I was busy. And I never bothered to RSVP. Besides, I'm the singer. I'm the singer. Surely, they could have let us into the reception. Ruthanna started to weep because she knew she had missed that lavish banquet, all because she failed to RSVP. And she felt a different sting. Being a follower of Christ, she said, I wonder if that's just not a glimpse of the taste of what somebody will feel at the point at which they arrive in heaven and said, I missed my chance. Throughout the ages, countless people have been just too busy to respond. Maybe some assume, hey, I'm good to go already anyway. Maybe some say, you know, I got to be okay. I mean, I've attended church enough, or I've been baptized. I mean, all kinds of ways that you could try to say I'm good. But you're not good. You're not good unless you come to Christ. You've come to Him and you've said, I need you. I need you to forgive me. I need you to write my name in your book of life. Because that's the only way I'm going to get heaven. Today as we close, heaven and hell are real. I'm hoping I've convinced you of that. And now it's time to respond to that invitation. Jesus is calling you, and He's saying, take my hand, accept my blood, follow me, and I will give you life. I will give you safety. I will give you heaven. Lord, this is your word. We acknowledge that you speak very pointedly about an afterlife. And it's of serious consequence. Lord, I have to believe that there's some people here today that said, I've never really thought that long about that, that clearly about that. And it makes me motivated. It makes me say, wow, let me respond now while I can. And it's as simple as saying yes to you as Savior. And I'm praying that there's individuals that will do that today and they'll let a friend know. I've made that decision and I want to follow up on that now. I want to learn more about Jesus in the Scriptures. I want to learn how to pray. I want to learn what it's like to be a part of His family. For the rest of us, Lord, today is just a reminder about an eternity that's ahead, and it makes us ever more grateful that we have gained something we did not deserve, heaven and eternal rest with you. How can we say, I love you enough? We can't, but we try today, Lord, in just simple terms of just being humble before you. And we all pray this in the name of that Lamb who was slain on our behalf, Jesus.